Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 84. I'll call this psalm, My Soul Longs for the Courts of the Lord. The header of this psalm, the heading, is, quote, For the director of music, according to Gittith of the sons of Korah, a psalm. Now, what's a Gittith? The NIV note says it is probably a musical term. The psalm is said to be of the sons of Korah. Korah was a grandson of Levi. So he was one of the priestly families. His family was responsible for carrying the tabernacle, the frame of the tabernacle. Korah, of course, is famous for getting swallowed up alive by the ground after a dispute with Moses in Numbers 16. Korah's rebellion, it's called. Now, the sons of Korah were a choir of Levites that King David appointed to serve in the temple of worship. That was nice. I guess they got over the infamy of their family's name. So David appointed Asaph as the leader of the choir. And now the sons of Korah are a choir of Levites singing in the temple worship. Now, did this choir endure after David's death? It might have, since the NIV Study Bible says this psalm perhaps occurred during Sennacherib's time. Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, attacked Israel, I think it was 701 B.C., so that's a long time after David, who ruled from 1010 to 970 B.C. So the title does not tie down the time of the psalm, which is very typical of these psalms. So now we start in verse 1 and go to verse 2 in Psalms 84. How lovely are your dwelling places, O Lord of hosts! My soul longed and even yearned for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. How lovely are your dwelling places! God's got more than one dwelling place? What does that mean? Does it mean he's living in heaven and he's living in the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle? I don't think so. The King James has, how lovely are your tabernacles, plural. The NIV has, how lovely is your dwelling place, singular. But the NIV is a loose translation, so let's assume it's plural, as the NASB has it. Why is it plural? Well, John Gill says that the plural dwelling places of the Lord refer to several parts of the tabernacle. We read in Hebrews 9, verses 2 through 3, For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one. Of course, that would be the holy place, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil, that would be the Holy of Holies. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies. So right there in verses 2 and 3 of Hebrews 9, there are two places listed as a tabernacle. Of course, a tabernacle is a place where God lives, so he lives in the holy place in verse 2, Hebrews 9, and in verse 3, Hebrews 9, he lives in the Holy of Holies. So that makes sense. That's why it's plural. Adam Clark says this, In this plural noun, he appears to include all the places in or near the temple where acts of divine worship were performed. So Clark takes the idea of different places in the tabernacle as being where God dwells. He goes even further than that, and he says, not only the Holy of Holies and the holy place, but also the altar of incense. Well, that's in the holy place. The altar of burnt offering, that's outside in the courtyard. All called here God's tabernacles or dwelling places, for wherever God was worshipped, there he was supposed to dwell. Well, I think that's a little loose. Adam Clark is, so we'll just take it as the Holy of Holies and the holy place is the two places where God lives. And that's why it's plural, the dwelling places of the Lord. How lovely are your dwelling places, O Lord of hosts, say the sons of Korah. Now, of course, I've assumed this was the tabernacle of Moses. It could be the Temple of Solomon. We don't know exactly when this psalm was written, but I'm going to assume it's the tabernacle just to make things easier. The psalmist says in verse 2, My soul longed and even yearned for the courts of the Lord. That's the tabernacle or the temple, but I say it's the tabernacle probably. My heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. So you see, the tabernacle was not a place of Lord, I've got to keep the law. I've got to go offer these sacrifices. No, it was a place of joy, a place where they could sing. They did sing. That's what the sons of Korah did. They were a choir. Asaph banged on cymbals, and he was the choir director. Now, in verse 2, the psalmist says, My soul longed and even yearned for the courts of the Lord. The NIV Study Bible suggests this, quote, The writer was probably someone who normally served in the temple, but was prevented from doing so for some reason. Perhaps this psalm was written when Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, was threatening the temple in Jerusalem, or it might refer to being in captivity in another country. In other words, speculation, we don't know. But the idea that he is yearning to be in the courts of the Lord, it kind of gives the idea that he is prevented from getting to the courts of the Lord, and he is sorry for it, and he's longing, yearning to get back to the tabernacle. My heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. So even in the Old Testament, they did not look at God as a God who was a killjoy, who was standing over them with a mattock trying to smash their brains in because they violated the law. That's not the way they looked at God. Why yearn to be in the tabernacle? Why should the psalmist yearn to be there? Because that's where God lived. So really, the psalmist is ultimately yearning for God, for fellowship with God, for union with God. We go down to Psalms 84, verses 3 through 4. The bird also has found a house, the psalmist continues, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Even your altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. How blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you, Selah. Now in verse 3, the bird has found a house. Other translations have sparrow, like the KJV and the NIV. The sparrow has found a house, and the swallow a nest. Two kinds of birds. Depends on how it's translated. They find a nest. Well, what's that got to do with being happy about the courts of the yard? What's that got to do with being happy about the courts of the Lord and wanting to be there? Well, because the nest is a place where she may lay her young, even your altars in verse 3. In other words, the bird is somewhere around those altars and has found a place to make its nest. And so the bird has satisfied his longing to be in the courts of the Lord, and so the psalmist wants to do the same thing. Now, here's some options as to where the bird's nest actually is, on the altars, physically on the altars. Gill and Clark say it's unlikely because the priests were working around the altars and they would run the birds off with all the noise, fire, and smoke going on. I think that makes sense. Could be that the nest were in the rafters of the temple, or maybe in trees near the temple, or maybe in some unspecified place near the altar. The NIV translation says this, even the sparrow has found a home and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar. So it's sort of indefinite as where the nest are. But the idea is the bird is at the altar, and that's where the psalmist wants to be. Verse 4, how blessed are those who dwell in your house. Those birds are blessed by being in the house of God, and I want to be blessed by being in the house of God. They are ever praising you. The birds are singing praise to God in the house of the Lord near the altar, and I want to do the same thing, says the psalmist. Selah, of course, that's the unknown term, which probably means let's pause and take a minute and think about this. Nobody really knows. We go now to Psalm 84, verses 5 through 7. The psalmist continues, how blessed is the man whose strength is in you, and whose heart are the highways to Zion. Passing through the valley of Baca, they make it a spring. The early rain also covers it with blessings. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them appears before God in Zion. Now this phrase, highways to Zion, is an interesting phrase. It's not translated uniformly that way. This is the NASB translation that translates it, highways to Zion. Let's look at some other translations. The KJV says the ways of them instead of highways to Zion, the ways of them, which makes no sense to me. And in fact, Adam Clark says, quote, this makes no sense. He must not be a KJV only guy. He speculates, Clark does, that perhaps the KJV means that these people are on a highway to a city of refuge. I don't know how he gets that from the KJV translation. I don't know. All right, here's another translation. This is the Holman Christian Study Bible. Happy are the people whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. Well, highway to Zion could be referring to people going down to Jerusalem for the three feasts. And the Holman Christian Study Bible just translates it a little bit more indefinitely. People who have their hearts set on pilgrimage are going to Jerusalem. The ESV translates it as highways to Zion with to Zion in italic, showing that to Zion is not in the original. So blessed are those in whose heart are highways, period. Well, I can see why they added to Zion, because otherwise it makes no sense. They get the Zion added to the original Hebrew because we see in verse 7, every one of them appears before God in Zion. So they're going to Zion. So highways to Zion is a reasonable translation, a reasonable interpolation, if you will. Now, the Bible in Basic English, as well as the New American Standard Bible, have highways to Zion. Darby merely has the highways, in whose heart are the highways, no to Zion. God's Word translation says, in whose heart are the road that leads to you. Instead of leading to Zion, it's leading to God, which is the same idea. Psalm 84, 5, the New American Bible says, happy are those who find refuge in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrim roads. That's very similar to the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. And then the Young's Literal Translation says, oh, happiness of a man whose strength is in thee. Highways are in their heart. just highways, not highways to Zion, but just highways. Well, I think highways to Zion is a perfectly reasonable translation when you look at verse 7. These happy people, these blessed people are going to Zion, and that's Jerusalem, and that's where God lives. And there are highways down there, and they're on the highway, and that's why they're blessed. Now, on their way to Zion, where God dwells, these men, of course, have their hearts set on getting back to where God dwells. They're going to Zion. We need to stop and see what the symbolism of Zion is. Now, physically, Zion can refer to different things. It can refer to Zion proper, which is the city of David, that little tongue of land between the Tyrrhenian and Kidron Valley. Or it could refer to the city of David plus Mount Moriah, the little square area north of, well, maybe northwest of Mount Zion, where the temple was built, the Temple Mount, in Solomon's time. Sometimes Zion just refers to the whole city of Jerusalem, and sometimes Zion refers to the whole land of Israel. The context will tell you, but that's not what's important. The spiritual meaning of Zion is the place where God dwells with his people, because the tabernacle was on Mount Zion proper when David got it there eventually, got the ark there and built another tabernacle for it, and that's where God dwells. And so Zion becomes a great symbol of where God dwells. Now, in the New Testament, Zion is where God dwells. Also, the church, Hebrews 12:22. Instead, you have come to Mount Zion. This is the author of Hebrews talking to Christian believers. Instead, you have come to Mount Zion. He's not talking about a physical Mount Zion. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God. Remember, Abraham was searching for the city that did not have foundations. Of course, that's the heavenly city. And the author of Hebrews says right here, the city of the living God, Mount Zion, is the heavenly Jerusalem. That sounds like the Jerusalem coming down out of heaven in the book of Revelation, which, of course, is the New Testament church in its final glorified state. Well, actually, I believe it's in the New Covenant state, but most people take it to be the final glorified state. But the idea is it's where God dwells with his people. It's not a hill in Jerusalem. So these people are walking to Zion, and they are, of course, a type and symbol of believers in the New Testament who are on the highway to Zion, on the highway to where God lives. They pass through the Valley of Baca. Now, Baca is an interesting word. I've seen so many devotional pieces talking about traveling through the Valley of Baca, and I used to think to myself, where is that? Well, it turns out nobody really knows. Let me give you some learned opinion from, first, the NIV Study Bible. Quote, the meaning is uncertain. It may refer to a valley of balsam trees that grow in dry areas, or it might be an imaginary valley full of dryness and sorrow. Well, there's two options. Valley of balsam trees, don't know where that is, or an imaginary valley that doesn't even exist. In other words, it's poetic. Now, here's what Easton's Dictionary says, quoting the Revised Standard Version, saying that version of the Bible translates this as the Valley of Weeping, and in the margin they put the Valley of Balsam Trees. Probably a valley in some part of Palestine. Again, don't know exactly where it is, Easton says. Or generally some one of the valleys through which pilgrims had to pass on their way to the sanctuary of Jehovah on Zion. In other words, some valley somewhere in Israel that they went through, so it's not very precise. Or, Easton says, it may figuratively be a valley of weeping. Well, so there's another option, valley of weeping. So now we've got a dry valley, a balsam tree valley, an imaginary valley, or the valley of weeping. Onward we go and look at Fawcett's Bible Dictionary. Valley of Baca, i.e. the Vale of Tears. Well, that's very close to Valley of Weeping. Compare Bochum in Judges 2:5, which I'm going to read to you in just a minute. The place of weepers. Well, let me just tell you real quick. In Judges 2:5, God told the Israelites, you guys made covenant with these pagan Canaanites, therefore I'm not going to drive them out in front of you. Let me read that for you. Judges 2, verses 1 through 5. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim. That's our place now, the valley of Bochim. And said, I brought you out of Egypt and led you into the land I had promised to your fathers. I also said, I will never break my covenant with you. You are not to make a covenant with the people who are living in this land, and you are to tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. What is this that you have done? Therefore, I now say, I will not drive out these people before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a trap for you. When the angel of the Lord, and I'm going to assume that's Jesus, when the angel of the Lord had spoken these words to all the Israelites, the people wept loudly. So they named that place Bochim and offered sacrifices there to the Lord. So wherever Bochim was, I don't think anybody knows exactly, but wherever it was a place where God rebuked the people said he's not going to drive out the Canaanites, and the people cried over it, so it's called the Valley of Baca, which means the Valley of Weeping. And some people say the Valley of Baca is so close to the Valley of Baca that the Valley of Baca is also the same thing as the Valley of Weeping. That actually makes a lot of sense. Well, let me continue reading from the learned scholars. This is from Fawcett's Bible Dictionary. I've already started this. I'll start again. The Valley of Baca, i.e. the Vale of Tears, compare Bacchum in Judges 2:5, which I just read for you, the place of weepers. The Hebrew form in Psalms 84:6 means mulberry trees. The Hebrew poet, by play on the name, refers to the similar-sounding word for tears. The Baca, or mulberry, trees delight in a dry valley, such as the ravine of Hinnom below Mount Zion, where the Bacchaim, mulberry trees, are expressly mentioned on the ridge separating the valley of Rephaim from that of Hinnom. Now, the valley of Rephaim is a valley to the west of Jerusalem, and it runs down the side of Jerusalem till it hits Hinnom, which is the valley to the southern tip of Jerusalem. There are mulberry trees on the ridge between those two valleys. Abu Fadl says, Baca, he must be some Arabic commentator, says, Baca is the Arabic for a balsam-like shrub with round, large fruit, from which, if a leaf is plucked, a tear-like drop exudes. As the Valley of Baca represents a valley of drought spiritually and dejection, where the only water is that of tears, so the pilgrim's making it a well by having his strength in Jehovah symbolizes ever-flowing comfort and salvation. All right, so Fawcett, this is the same Fawcett of Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Fawcett tries to tie the Hebrew for the valley with plants that grow there that can be called balsam because it's a balsam-like shrub, or it could be called mulberry. It depends on how you translate it. And this plant, if you pluck it, it plucks a tear, which is a perfect symbol of how the Valley of Baca is Bacchum, the Valley of Bacchum, the Valley of Tears, like during the time of Joshua. Well, all that's very, very complicated. So let me summarize the options as to what the Valley of Baca is. Here's one scholar who says that the Valley of Baca is a valley of springs or fountains. I didn't write his name down. I forgot to. But if whoever this guy is right, then that means that the valley is exactly the backwards, the opposite of what the NIV Study Bible says, which said it was a valley of drought, of dryness, no water. So I don't like that option. That doesn't make any sense, because the idea is the springs come when the pilgrims going to Zion go through this dry valley. They turn it into a valley of plenteous water. So I'm going to drop that option. Here's second option, a valley of mulberry trees, could be. Another option, third option, the valley of Rephaim, which is mentioned in 2 Samuel 5:22. The Philistines came up again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. There's a big battle there. I'm sure you don't recall it, but I did an audio on that when I was on 2 Samuel 5. Now the Septuagint and Adam Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the Valley of Baca is the Valley of Weeping, which is the same as the Valley of Baca mentioned in Judges 2:1-5, which I just read for you. Adam Clark says this, quote, I believe Baca to be the same here as Bacchum, Judges 2:1-6, called the Valley of Weeping. And, of course, just because people are weeping there, that does not mean that the valley has lost its dryness. Weeping is not going to fill up a valley. Weeping does not preclude the idea of dryness. So again, whatever option we take, we're going to assume this valley is dry and made watered by the man who has a highway to Zion in his heart. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, through such valleys, by reason of their dry and barren condition, the worshipers often had to pass to Jerusalem. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, as I said, believes that the valley that is being referred to is the Valley of Weeping, as so does Adam Clark, as does the Septuagint. And I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. John Gill Punts, he says that the Valley of Baca seems not to designate any particular physical place. It's imaginary. It's poetic. That's the easiest thing to do, is just to say it's poetic, because the poetry is obvious what it means here. So these men who have in their heart a highway to Zion, they're heading to where God lives. They make a dry valley a spring because they bring nourishment to the land because God is with them. The early rain also covers it with blessings. They bring blessings to the land, just like the early rain does. The early rain was the rain that came in the spring for the wheat harvest. That's the early rain. The latter rain was not mentioned here, but it came in the autumn, right around the time of the autumn harvest, right before the Feast of Tabernacles, which was a harvest festival. Verse 7, these people who are in the valley of Baca who have in their hearts highways to Zion, they go from strength to strength. That means they start out strong, then they get stronger, and then they get stronger, and they get stronger again. Every one of them appears before God in Zion. That appearing before God might appear to the three times of the year that Jews had to appear before God by leaving their homes and going to Jerusalem and appearing before the temple and offering first fruits and sacrifices and so forth. They appear before God in Zion. There Zion is referring to Jerusalem, or maybe more precisely, Mount Zion, where the ark was in the time of David. But if this was written before the time of David, the tabernacle was in Kiriath-Jearim, was in Hebron. The tabernacle was in Hebron, and the ark was in Kiriath-Jearim. So maybe they were somehow appearing before the ark, separated from the tabernacle. I don't think so. I think they were probably appearing before the tabernacle in David's Jerusalem, in that new tabernacle that David built for the ark in Zion. So we could say Zion actually refers to the city of David, Zion proper. Doesn't really matter. It's Jerusalem at least. We go now to Psalms 84 verses 8 through 12, and we will finish this audio. The psalmist continues, O Lord God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob, Selah. Behold our shield, O God, and look upon the face of your anointed. For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 outside. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord gives grace and glory. No good thing does he withhold from those who walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, how blessed is the man who trusts in you. In verse 8, the psalmist says, Give ear, O God of Jacob. Jacob, of course, is another name for Israel, both nationally and personally, because the patriarch Jacob had two names. His original name, Jacob, meant deceiver or supplanter, because he supplanted Esau in the matter of Isaac's birthright, which was passed down to Jacob rather than Esau. And then later he was called Israel because he wrestled with God at Peniel on the way back from Syria. So, O God of Jacob means O God of Israel, O God of the nation of Israel. Selah. Pause. Let's think about it. Perhaps that's what that means. Behold our shield. Now, what is the shield? Here's some options. In verse 9, the shield could be the character of God himself, as John Gill and Adam Clark say. The KJV supports them. It says, Behold, O God, our shield. Shield is put in apposition with God, and so God is the shield. Now, favoring that interpretation also is verse 11, which says, For the Lord God is a sun and shield. So that's reasonable. Behold our shield, O God. Behold God, who is our shield. And look upon the face of your anointed. Well, a second option is the shield is the king in Jerusalem. And this is the option I favor. The NIV note, marginal note, says, Behold our sovereign, our king, in other words. And if you look at Hebrew parallelism there, that's why I think it's king, because the first part of verse 9 says, Behold our shield. Second part of verse 9 says, Look upon the face of your anointed. Well, who was the anointed? The king. So if the shield is in parallel with the anointed king, the shield is the king. Somebody else, some other scholar has said the shield is the sanctuary in Jerusalem. I don't think that's correct. So I'm going to take the shield as being the king. Look upon the face of your anointed. There are good reasons to say that it could be God himself rather than the king of Israel. And when I say the king of Israel, I don't mean a particular king, because we don't know who that is. Could be David in particular. Could be Zerubbabel, the king during the post-exilic times when the new temple was built. One commentator says, The anointed is not the king of Israel, but is rather the people of Israel. I don't know where he gets that from. So I think in verse 9, the psalmist is extolling the king of Israel, the anointed king of Israel. And verse 10, For a day in your courts, in God's courts, is better than 1,000 days outside of God's courts. The psalmist says, I would rather stand in the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. In other words, it's better to stand outside, not going into the house of God, but just thinking about it, just contemplating it, just looking inside, but still on the outside. I'd rather do that than get right into the midst, in the bosom of the tents of wickedness with all their worldly pleasures and comforts. And these tents here are probably the houses of princes and great men, not just the tents of ordinary people. And that, of course, makes the poetic contrast between a doorkeeper and a tent dweller more stark. I would rather stand outside the tabernacle than live in the midst of a fancy, wealthy Martha's Vineyard mansion. Now in verse 11, the psalmist says, For the Lord God is a sun and shield. If we take the first shield in verse 9 to be the king, well then God's a king too. He could be the two shields are the same, i.e. God, but I'm going to assume that the first shield in verse 9 is David, or the king of Israel, and verse 11, the shield is God. Now, God is also said in the first part of verse 11 to be a son. Why would God be compared to a son? Well, what does our sun do? It gives heat in the winter. It makes plants grow in the spring. In fact, it's absolutely necessary to survive. God is absolutely necessary for us to survive. A lot of people were well aware of the benefits of the sun back in the times of the ancient Near East, and they ended up worshiping the sun as a god. But no, our God is the sun. The Lord gives grace as unmerited favor, benefits, blessings, presence, and glory, the outward manifestation and public manifestation of one's excellent characteristics. No good thing does God withhold from those who walk uprightly. Now, there's a condition there. No good thing does he withhold from you. If you leave that out and say, oh, God will just give you whatever you want, that's not the way it works. You got to walk uprightly. You sin, he'll take it away from you. Now, walking uprightly does not mean walking in sinless perfection. The NIV translates it, those who walk blameless, God will not withhold any good thing. That sounds like the man whose heart has a highway to Zion, who loves God, has got to be absolutely perfect, absolutely blameless. That's the NIV translation. I don't like it because that translation makes it sound like someone must be perfect to receive God's blessings. Well, that can't be it. I like the KJV translation better. The man who walks uprightly will not have any good thing withheld. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says, quote, the walk of those who seek God's will. This doesn't imply perfection, but undivided loyalty. No one is completely blameless before the Lord since we've all sinned. But when God grants forgiveness, we become blameless in his sight. Here are two Davidic psalms that talk about men walking with integrity or blamelessness or uprightness. Psalm 15:2. The author of this psalm is David. He says this, he who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. Psalms 18:23. This is also a psalm of David. I was also blameless with him, and I kept myself from iniquity. And that word blameless in the NASB, Psalms 18:23, in the KJV is uprightly. I was also upright with him. I walked uprightly with him. I like uprightly better than blameless because of the misunderstandings that might arise from the word blameless. Now, one other thing before I close this down. In verse 10, the psalmist says, I would rather stand at the threshold of my God. The NIV and the KJV says, I would rather be a doorkeeper. So what does that mean, stand at the threshold? Well, it could be option A, a doorkeeper, or it could be a beggar, because beggars used to lay at the gates of the temple asking for alms. I'd rather be a beggar standing at the threshold asking for alms than to live in the tents of the mighty and the wicked. Another option is it could be a slave, a servant, who wanted to convert his temporary slavery to a permanent slavery. We read in Exodus 21, verse 6, then his master shall bring him to God, then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Well, notice where the slave who was commuting his seven-year slavery service to a lifetime of service, he did it by going to the door or the doorpost of the temple or the tabernacle. And that might be what's being referred to here by the psalmist. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God as a slave rather than dwell in the tents of wicked, powerful, wealthy people. Ladies and gentlemen, with those abundantly wise and clear exhortations, we are finished with Psalms chapter 84. We are now prepared to go to Psalms 85, verses 1 through 13, which I will entitle Revive Us Again. I hope you stay tuned for that edifying psalm, and I hope you enjoyed this one.